Hey everyone, welcome back. This week our guest is Derek Sivers, a writer, programmer, entrepreneur, and former owner of CD Baby, an online store for independent musicians. This episode is in two parts, and today we're talking about building a life around values such as learning, growth, and minimalism, and exploring freedom to its extremes. Find all the links and show notes at futurethinkers.org/116. And a quick announcement, our giveaway contest is continuing into its third round. Enter to win 6 months worth of Future Thinkers membership and 1 month supply of Qualia Nootropic Energy. You can go to futurethinkers.org/giveaway to check that out. Hey, and welcome to futurethinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to futurethinkers.org/start. So thanks for joining us. It's really cool that you're kind of coming out of your recluse years, it seems. And I'd love to...
Wait, sorry, what was that word? Recluse years?
Recluse year.
Recluse years.
Oh, I thought you made it. I thought that was like a fancy French word, like your recluse year. <Yeah. laughs> I don't know that one. Yeah. Sorry. Okay, reclusive years. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'd love to hear about what you've been up to, and you're working on three books right now. So one of them is called Hell Yeah or No, which is a title that very much speaks to us. And I'd love to hear about that and the kind of philosophy behind that that approach to life.
Okay, you want to hear about that now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so Hell Yeah or No is, it's really just a very tiny idea. And it goes like this, that we tend to say yes to too many things. And because of this, we're spread too thin. We're so busy doing average things that we don't have time for the occasional great thing. So instead, I propose raising the bar as high as you can. So that if you're feeling anything less than, oh, hell yeah, that would be amazing, then just say no. By doing this, you will miss out on many good things, but that's okay because your time will be quite empty. So then by saying no to the merely good things, you'll have the time and the energy and the space in your life to throw yourself in entirely when that occasional great thing comes up. So that's it.
I can imagine, just because we also have a content brand, I can imagine the comment section could get pretty ugly at that. What do you think, what kind of responses do you get to that idea? Like, you know, oh, easy for you to say or something like that. Like what,
oh, like
and
that.
How do you respond?
Well, no, the only ones that I feel the need to correct people on are when they try to apply this rule to everything. Hmm. So they say, like, I'll get an email from somebody saying, yeah, I'm just out of college and looking at a bunch of job offers, but man, none of them are a hell yeah. So I'm just saying no to all of them. I'm like, no, hold on. This is a specific tool for a specific situation. It's when you're overwhelmed and you have too many options and you want to prevent drowning, then you use this tool. It's not meant to be used for everything in life. It's not meant to be used for, I think there are different stages. I mean, the different stages of your life need different strategies. So if you're at the beginning of your career and you're trying to discover where your lottery tickets are going to hit in life, because, you know, it's some skill and some luck, then it's a better strategy to say yes to everything. And it's usually after somebody gets successful, then they're drowning in opportunities. You know, they say that most small businesses don't die of starvation. They drown. They drown in opportunities because they say yes to too many things. So I just think that when you're successful at something, when you're overwhelmed with opportunity, then you use hell yeah or no as a decision-making tool to keep you focused.
Yeah, I'm really glad you made that clarification, actually. That was a little bit of a question mark for me, but that really applies. I can see that in my life as I'm, you know, attached to my screen are 1,000 sticky notes of all the things I have to do.
We'll get into this later, I imagine, about minimalism and stuff like that. But to me, it's kind of all tied together. It's about constantly asking yourself what's really important, what's necessary, and then getting rid of the rest. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's your idea that you've talked about recently of building your life around your values. So I'd like to hear about, first of all, how you pick those values that are important for you. And of course, they're going to be different for everybody at different stages in their lives. And also, I'd like to hear about some of your experiments in arranging your life around those values and how they've gone well, or maybe how they've completely gone wrong or just had really unexpected, ridiculous results.
Okay, cool. I mean, first I should say that I'm not looking for a normal life. So if I say things that sound strange, like a lot of my friends often say, like, why do you feel this need to be so all or nothing, so black or white? It's like, well, because I like exploring the extremes. And in a way, I think it's more honest. So here's why. When I realize that one value has a higher priority than another value, I have to ask myself if I'm living accordingly. So like if I say that my kid is more important to me than my phone, it's one thing to say that. But if I'm on my phone when I'm with my kid, then now I'm living, it's like I'm lying with my actions. I'm living incongruently. I'm saying this thing is more important than, I'm saying that my hierarchy is like this, but my actions are proving otherwise. So I feel I need the need to sort that out. Is my phone actually more important to me than my kid? Was I lying about what I said? Or if not, then why are my actions not in line with my beliefs? And so then I'll do some daydreaming or journaling or whatever you want to call it, and I'll figure out how it would look if my actions were in line with my beliefs. I'll usually take each belief system to its logical conclusion. You know what I mean? Like I enjoy taking it all the way to say, if that's really true, then, you know. And so in that tiny example I just said, it would be like, I will, anytime I'm with my kid, I'll just keep my phone off, like completely off, or in airplane mode or silent. Like I will not touch it when I'm with him. He is always more important than the phone. But let's pick a more interesting, like nuanced one. Like if I say that learning and growing is my top value, and I say that yeah, this is what's most important to me in life, you know, I'm saying, okay, maybe like, here's the health and well-being of my kid. Here's learning and growing. Like I wouldn't sacrifice my kid in the name of learning and growing. But so that is that obvious exception aside. So if I say that learning and growing is my top value, but I'm living in a comfortable house in a familiar neighborhood with a nice fire in the fireplace in a neighborhood full of people like me, I have to ask myself, is this congruent with my values? I'm not sure. I need to explore that. Like I could be right now living in a slum in Mumbai and having more of a learning, growing experience. But would the friction of that cause me to grow less in other ways? Like would the friction of daily life somewhere difficult actually slow my learning, growing progress in other ways? Or would it actually enhance it? So sometimes I'll go experiment with these things. I'll go live somewhere very uncomfortable and see how that does with learning and growing, or at least I'll like daydream about it and make plans of it. Like maybe I don't want to up and move my whole life just for an experiment like this, but these are the kinds of like this, that's a better example of something that I'm always, always wondering and always exploring. And maybe it helps that I'm not just willing, but enthusiastic to try living an extreme life. It's extremely in accordance with my values and beliefs. Does that make sense?
Yep.
I don't think I've ever explained that to somebody before. So I don't know if that was just, you know, vague rambling or not.
Yeah. I mean, if you give some examples, that'd be awesome. Like, what are some experiments that you've done where you actually voluntarily threw yourself into uncomfortable, unfamiliar situations to see what would happen?
I mean, I've moved a lot. So I moved to Singapore 10 years ago and just kind of made this, oh God, I mean, sorry, you're bringing up a whole bunch. I married somebody I had just met to experiment with the idea of commitment. I moved to Singapore with one suitcase to experiment, like understanding a different way of looking at the world. Like the Confucian values of living in Asia are so different from my individualistic American values that it took me a while to adapt to that, and just the whole kind of lifestyle of that. I'll experiment with social things, like if I find myself too loyal to the self-definition of being an introvert, I feel the need to question that. Like I like to break loyalties and question things that I think are true. So if I find myself believing something too strongly, that makes me want to try going against it to see what happens. So I'll go be an extrovert for a while and I'll go meet with everybody and be around people all the time and experiment with that. And then I tried, I moved to New Zealand to go experiment with 6 years of solitude. Not solitary confinement in a jail, but relative solitude to the rest of my life. And then just now where I'm living in Oxford, I had been living so minimalistic for so long that I moved here and experimented with the opposite. Like I got a house and I furnished it. I got a car and like all that kind of stuff that I thought I would never have. I just decided to try it. I have a stocked kitchen now. That's really weird for me. I have like a cutting board. I'd never had a cutting board before. I don't know. So I'm experimenting with it and I'm not sure I like it. I think I might give away everything again next year and go back to what feels more honest to me, which is to just have only the things that I use every single week. And if I don't use it every week, I really don't need it.
It's funny how many similarities there are between us in this respect. Like this kind of, first of all, investigating our ideas about life to their endpoints. That's one thing that we've really done a lot over the years. And there, another part is this experimentation and travel has been a really big part of that. We left Canada in 2013, I think it was, and then have lived all over Southeast Asia. And now we live in Bulgaria. So it's kind of a similar thing, this minimalist, away from the Western world. But one thing I've noticed along the way is there are a lot of people who've done something similar, made a business, and had some success with it, and then fallen into some kind of existential crisis of like, okay, well, I've done this, now what? And I'm wondering if that was the case for you as well.
Well, I think it's because you have a blank slate and you have the time. So, an ex was asking me, as I was doing my usual kind of pondering and this kind of stuff we're talking about. Oh, and the fact that I write in my journal like 1 to 3 hours a day, right? Often just daydreaming possible futures and other things I could be doing with my life. I'll just often write about these kind of things. And she said, have you always been like this? And I said, yeah, I've always been. And I had to stop myself going, wait, have I always been like this? No. It actually started not when I sold the company, but when I was free of it, like labor-wise. Like there was a year or two before I sold the company, I basically was just the owner, but I wasn't required to be anywhere or do anything. So I think that's when it all started, because for the rest of my life up until then, I was just like very... the horse blinders on, like very like head down, very focused. Like I am working on this and I'm driven and just all other options can piss off. Like it just, I know exactly what I'm after. I always found it weird when like people would like read blogs. I'm like, You're reading. Don't you know what you want in life? What are you reading blogs for?
How do you have the time for that?
Yes, like all this stuff. Like I just felt like I was on an absolute like laser focused mission for like 20 years, 24 years to be exact. From the age of 14 to 38, I was pursuing one single thing. And then at 38, that's when the one thing I had been pursuing for the last 10 years, CD Baby, my company, suddenly I was free of it. And it just felt like this huge blank slate. And my first impulse was to do more of the same. So it's like literally the day after I sold my company, I slept well that night with an empty head. And the next morning I woke up and I was making breakfast and I went, oh, I just had an idea for my next company, you know, and I immediately dove into that. It was called Muckwork, and I spent like the next 3 or 4 months just immediately like programming it, and I hired a manager. I dove into it. I was like, right, this is my next thing. I believe in this completely. And after 4 months, I had to stop myself because I realized that my trajectory would be exactly the same. I would take one company name off my mantelpiece, what do you call that? Yeah, over the over your door, you know, take one company name off and put a different company name there, but my actions and my life would remain exactly the same. So that's when I realized, like, no, I want to make a real change. So that's when I started more with this kind of blank slate approach to life, and also the habit of deliberately saying no to all the things I used to say yes to, and saying yes to all the things I used to say no to, just to do this like deliberate squelching of previous habits.
There are so many kind of parallels in a lot of spiritual paths as well with this, like the minimalism, the deconstruction work, all of this stuff. Did you actually have that existential crisis at some point after? You know, it sounds like you immediately went back into it, but at some point, did you kind of have any breakdown of being like, this is not what I'm doing anymore. I'm changing as a person.
Oh yeah, a bit. I mean, to me, it was the asking yourself, is there such a thing as too much freedom? So this is what I found myself asking before I sold the company, but that last year where I was no longer necessary. I was the owner. It was very profitable and it was completely delegated. They didn't need me for anything. So I found myself asking these two questions. What do you do when you don't have to do anything and you can do anything? And where do you go when you don't have to be anywhere and you can be anywhere? It kind of messed me up that it's like I had a lot of money in the bank and I had just broken up with my girlfriend like a year or two before. I was just completely free and nobody was expecting me to be anywhere. And I just had this bank account in this time. I could just start an ostrich farm in Mongolia if I want to, or, you know, take scuba diving lessons in Iceland or go learn Arabic in Egypt. It's like just, it was like too wide open. And so every day I just kind of kept thinking, or I was overwhelmed with all the different things I could be doing. And maybe that's where this questioning of values comes into it. You have to ask yourself, okay, well, I can do anything. Like what are my values? Sometimes you can do that just by asking yourself and writing in your diary. You can say, well, these are my values. But it can be more effective to look back at your past and ask yourself, like, when was I happiest and why? Or what seems to be a constant thread through my past? Like a constant thread of what's worked for me consistently in the past? What do I tend to like?
And so what did you arrive at through that exploration? You mentioned your value of learning and growing, that you hold that pretty highly. Was there anything else that you noticed, any other threads?
Happy, smart, and useful. This was a big one. I realized that whenever my life feels unsatisfying, it's because I'm not satisfying all three of those. The intersection of what makes me happy, what's smart, meaning long-term good for me and what's useful to others. So it's okay to do one or two of those, but I think if you're not doing all three, something ultimately feels unsatisfying. You know, and you could do these combinations. Like you could do something that makes you happy and is smart, but if it's not useful to others, it just kind of feels, you know, circular, self-contained. You could do something that's useful for others and might be smart, but if you're not happy doing it, then it's like, we can try to talk ourselves out of happiness, but it's kind of like the oil in the machine, you know, like the machine starts to break down if it doesn't have that, the oil of happiness. Yeah, so that's a common thread I noticed.
Are you familiar with the Japanese concept of ikigai?
No, I've heard the word, but I never found out what it means.
It's pretty much exactly that. So it's a Venn diagram that is the overlap of what you love, what you're good at, what you can get paid for, and what the world needs.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
Cool.
And so...
Damn, I thought I came up with that.
That's another funny thing I've noticed, too. Like, the more time you have to reflect, the more kind of... Well, if they all feel like brilliant, unique ideas, and then you recognize like brilliant and unique people have also come up with those things too. So right. It's kind of it's complimentary, I think.
That's what freaked me out about when I was 42 when I read my first book on Stoicism, and I went, "Holy shit!" I thought it was just me. Like, yeah. this is my quirky, weird Derek philosophy I've been living by since I was like 14 years old. Like all this whole thing about making life deliberately tough on yourself to strengthen yourself for the unknown future. Like all this stuff is like my quirky philosophy I've been living by for 25 years. And holy shit, it's got a name. It's got an ism. It's 2,000 years old. That's amazing. Yeah, that blew my mind to realize it wasn't just me.
Yeah, that's really the same for me as well. That's been one of those things that has been uncovered after years and years of practice and ignorance.
I think it's really interesting to look at these kinds of patterns, you know, insights or whatever, and recognize how common they are in history or in different wisdom traditions. There's something about it that kind of it's like it's our common humanity, you know? If you look deep enough into the abyss, something looks back, and it's often similar things for people. Like, in some ways, we're not so unique. I think it's very humbling in a positive way, you know?
I think about, did you guys know that, sorry, this was new to me, this maybe you've known this forever, that eyeballs evolved in nature like 40 different unrelated times. That it's not like if you look at a squid and their eyeballs are kind of similar to ours, it's not like, oh, we have some common parent with eyeballs. No. It's the whole idea of two eyes filled with liquid and a lens and a retina and all that, like independently evolved like 40 different times. So it's like nature over and over and over again has decided this is a way to see predators and prey and to get visual information. It's reinvented the same way almost over and over again. That's really cool. So I think about that with what you just said philosophically. It's like you could just sit all by yourself, completely disconnected from the world, come up with something and find out, yeah, it's the same thing that everybody else came up with because maybe it's the logical conclusion.
Yeah, there is an interview we did a little while back with Dean Radin who talks about real magic. And he goes over experiments that have been shown to when animals and humans come up with ideas all over the world at the same time. Like one example was this flock of crows. I think it was in England. And they all suddenly gained the knowledge all at once of how to open the milk caps on the milk that was being delivered to everyone's homes in the morning. And like across the country, all of them learned it all at once.
Wow.
Yeah.
The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses, get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members. enter the Future Thinkers giveaway and win our brand new community membership, including in-depth courses, private calls, and more, as well as a supply of Qualia, a complete cognitive upgrade for your brain. To enter the contest, simply go to futurethinkers.org/giveaway and sign up for our mailing list to instantly get our 50-page guide on how to adapt to the future. There are many ways to increase your chances of winning. Enter the competition today. You talk about your love for stoicism or minimalism. So I wanted to pick your brain about that a bit. How has that manifested in your life? And what kind of things have emerged from it as a result of practicing it? So what have been some of the second order effects of choosing that lifestyle that might not be obvious for people?
Okay. I think this is something I've never really talked about. So thanks for bringing it out. We often think of minimalism in terms of stuff. But to me, I just find, talk about like the common thread when I look back about what's made me happiest for my whole life. Minimalism is one of those things that just over and over and over again, I just get such joy out of seeing what I can do without. So the core idea of minimalism, right? This idea that stuff weighs you down with more downsides than upsides. Like often when we get something in our life, we think of the upside of it, but to me, I see the downsides more than the upside. So some aspects of this are, say, taking things seriously. So the I guess these might be like, you call them second order effects. So taking things seriously, for example. So considering the long-term impact of things, not just the environmental impact, but like the impact on your psyche of having a thing. Like if I were to hang a clarinet on the wall in front of me right now, that would do something to my psyche. I'd be thinking I should be playing that clarinet or I should be doing something. It's like everything in my life feels like it should have some purpose. So if it's sitting there with no purpose, it's like a little part of my brain is still spinning about that thing. Letting go of the unimportant to leave space. So kind of like minimalist music has space between the notes. So I think of that in my own life, like leaving space in my life. That's kind of the hell yeah or no thing. It's like, it's okay to like leave your time and your calendar empty. Because if you have space in your life, then you can throw yourself all in when you find something great. Focusing my attention. So like minimalist art, for example, we'll just put, you know, one single line and a circle. And by doing that, it says like, no, really focus on that and that. And so I think of that in life. Like when you get rid of everything else that doesn't matter, you really focus on the few things that are left. Like it's really the, I was gonna say, what's the opposite of diffused? But I guess if focused is the opposite of diffused. It's a very focused attention. I think it keeps you future focused too, because when you're future focused, you're often doing things today in service of your future self, right? You're not living for today. You're living for future you. So being minimalist means that future you will have less to look after, less to maintain, less to store, less to upkeep. You know, we talked about programming for a second before. So having less code today means less that your future self has to maintain and upgrade when packages are upgraded or whatever. So yeah, being minimalist, it's second order effect, being more future focused. Having less baggage gives you more options in life. So I think there are a lot of people I know quite well that would consider doing different things in their life, but they live in a big house with a lot of stuff and a big mortgage. And so can't, you know, they just have too much stuff that they've grown accustomed to too. So they start to think of too many things as necessities. So even the idea of traveling with one bag, they're just like, I can't, I need too much stuff every day, but it's because they have too much stuff. They go, so it's, they've reduced their options in life because they have too much stuff. Two more. So having a small identity, So instead of saying like, I am a programmer, rock climber, a musician, cyclist, Republican, Buddhist, French film fan, clarinet player. that's a lot of identity to maintain. Like if you say, I am these things, well, then that's a lot of actions you're going to have to do to uphold that identity. Because you can't just keep saying that you are something if your actions are not supporting it anymore. You can't say you're a rock climber if you haven't climbed rocks in 20 years. So by, like, identity can be baggage. And lastly, a second order effect would be more deciding that it means almost every day or very, very often you're making real decisions about what's important and what's not. Deciding what's important and letting go of the rest. So I do this every day. Like I constantly look at everything in my life, like even, you know, that whole list of things I just said. And I think I look at all these things saying, do I really need that? Both physical and non-physical, you know, do I really need these things? Do I really need that identity as part of my identity? Do I really need that code in my site? Do I really need that functionality in my website? Are people using that? If not, get rid of it. Do I really need all these old photos? Am I using them? Do I really need, you know, like all of these things. That goes for goals. I'm constantly letting go of goals. I had tons of past goals that I'm constantly looking through these goals going, do I need that goal anymore? Like, yeah, that was something I wanted to do 8 years ago and I haven't done it yet. But every day I keep that goal in my list of goals, it does something to my psyche keeping it there. Contacts, I constantly go through my phone. If there's somebody I haven't talked to in a year and I'm like not desperately missing them, I just delete it. So like my phone has, I think, 25 contacts in it. That's it, which is wonderful. Food, I get rid of every food I don't like, you know, sometimes I'll buy food thinking, yeah, I'll cook something with that tempeh, you know, it doesn't happen, I get rid of it. Habits, there's some habits I just do that maybe started for a good reason long ago, but if I notice that I'm still doing them, but they don't have a place in my life anymore, I get rid of it. My phone only has two apps on it because I just realized like all these other apps I don't really use. So I just have the two that I actually use, yeah. God, sorry, that was a really long answer.
It was a really, really good one because kind of grounding it in very real life things rather than keeping it abstract, I think is really useful for people because it gives them ideas of how they can do it in their own life if they're considering it.
And maybe they don't want to. So like my sister, for example, is the opposite. She lives in a huge house with like four kids and two dogs and tons of stuff. And that makes her happy. And so just because somebody might be a fan of your podcast or something like that doesn't mean that they need to buy into this, you know? We might just want it in one little aspect of your life. I like it because it, for some weird reason, it feels better to me to have less, just in general. At any given moment, I would rather be in an empty room than in a full room. I'd rather have an empty calendar than a full calendar. Some people are the opposite. Like they feel alive when their calendar is full and they feel alive if they have a million contacts in their phone. I feel the opposite. I like that space to grow, to change, and to focus. Also, I really like challenging myself to see what I can do without, because the comfort I get from knowing and proving to myself that I don't need something is ultimately greater than the comfort of having it, of having something. You know what I mean? It's like a greater comfort to know I don't need it. So I'm constantly pushing myself to see what I don't need.
And you haven't really talked about this very much, but I really wonder, because when you remove all the stuff, and there's all this space, that space is a space of potentiality. So what kind of things emerge from that? It's like if you're, every minute of your day is filled with meetings and things, then there's no space for that emergence.
I can't help but think of like my own, like this is just applying so much to me right now in like what I need to change. And I'm like trying to focus on an interview, but I'm also like, fuck. Man, there's so many things I'm doing right now. I need to stop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a little bit the opposite. Like, we've added, I don't know, 8 or 10 new projects to our plate in the last couple months.
It's an experiment. It's all an experiment. You know, it's funny. I'd be the worst accountability buddy. I have this one dear friend of mine. She's one of my best friends, but she constantly wants to do that damn accountability partner kind of thing. She's like, oh, Derek, I want to go on a diet. Will you be my accountability buddy? Well, let's go do the diet at the same time and we'll hold each other to keeping to it. I'm like, I break loyalties every day. Like every day, it's something that I felt loyal to sometimes for decades. Like, you know what I just did a few weeks ago? This whole process we're talking about, I just gave away all of my music equipment, everything, all of my guitars, my keyboards, my everything but this microphone, because I thought it might have other non-musical uses. But it was just 2 or 3 weeks ago, I had been feeling this guilt every day about these two guitars that are sitting there that I just haven't been playing. And I say that it's an important value to me, but I'm not actually doing it. And I just, so every day I had this little bit of guilt, like, I should be spending more time doing that. I should. In fact, when I moved here from New Zealand to Oxford, England, I only own and only brought with me one paper book, and it's still here. It's called Great Songwriting Techniques by Jack Perricone, who is my old songwriting teacher at Berklee School of Music, 30 years ago. And it's the only book I brought with me, because I still had this in my list of goals. Like, I'm going to get back into songwriting. Like, I wrote 100 songs 20 years ago. I loved it. I still have this as part of my identity. Like, I'm a musician. I'm a songwriter. This is me. So just 3 weeks ago, when I thought, like, no, I really need to be spending more time on songwriting, I caught myself thinking, like, yeah, but, you know, 4 hours writing a song is 4 hours I could be spending doing something I really want to do more. I thought, God, I really need to let go of this whole music goal thing. Like, I need to let this go from my identity. So my best friend here in Oxford is a full-time musician, like a full-time professional musician. This is his living. So I called him up and I was like, how'd you like a couple new guitars? He's like, dude, are you seriously getting rid of your Strat? I want it. I was like, you can have my Strat, Tom. And I gave him my Strat. I gave him my wonderful 88 key weighted keyboard and the synth with 20 whatever gigs of sounds. And he's thrilled and he uses it every single day. I even gave him my speakers. I looked at my speakers. I was like, I got headphones. I don't need speakers. And gave it all away. That was like a huge identity thing for me to let go of that. I didn't regret it for 1 second. I even had a dog a few months ago. And then my mom said she was like wanting to adopt a dog. I was like, you know what? I don't really need my dog. You can have my dog. I gave her my dog.
I thought that story was going to have a much sadder ending to it. You just like,
hey, that dog, I just dog. But no, like even my dog, it's like I'd only had him for 6 months, but I thought I was going to have him for 12 years. He was a puppy. And like, then I just looked at my life and I was like, you know, that was the dog was a hypothesis. And my mom and her husband were like out there looking for that exact kind of dog. They were going around to dog shelters trying to adopt that kind of dog that I have. And I was just like, you know what, but I'm going to give you my dog. I have no loyalty except to my dear friends and family. And that's it. Even identities, habits, goals, no loyalty.
You know what I notice about watching you and listening to you is that you pretty much have a permanent smile the whole time.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's, yeah. I think it's reflective of these philosophies.
Well, we're also talking about something exciting, you know, if you start to bring up politics or say the T word. Yeah, it's been, you know. Yeah, we're talking about things I love talking about.
What's the T word?
Don't say it.
I don't know.
Any day I don't have to hear the T word is a good day.
Okay.
I actually don't even know what you're talking about.
I don't know what it is either.
Good. Then we won't talk about it.
Okay, great. Oh, okay. I got it. Yeah, it took a second. We live in a different part of the world where it's not an everyday occurrence.
Good.
But I'm really glad that you bring up the psychological aspect of stuff and of attachments. Because I really agree with you. They really take up space in your head. It's like they're little notifications that pop up, like, oh, I have to deal with this and I have to think about this. And especially with identity, because I really think that it takes energy to maintain an ego, you know? Because the ego has needs. It needs a reinforcement. It needs like proof in the world.
Validation.
It needs boundaries. It constantly pings you to do things for it.
Right. Which you may decide. You know what's interesting is I learned that there's the word. Okay. So stress. Stress has, we often think of it in terms of distress. Like negative stress, but positive stress is called eustress, E-U-S-T-R-E-S-S, eustress. And I thought that was such a cool term to learn because there are many times where you want this as your identity because it gives you that eustress. Like it actually pushes you in a way you want to be pushed. And therefore you keep that. Like if it nudges you away, you want to be nudged. But yeah, you have to keep asking yourself, if that's still true, even if it was true 10 years ago or 10 days ago, is it still true now?
I prefer to think about identity as clothing rather than skin, you know? Like you can put it on and take it off and you don't have to commit to it.
Do you guys have tattoos?
A few.
Yeah.
Okay. I never got tattoos because to me, it's like you just said, identity, clothes, skin. I was just like, anytime I considered it for 1 second, I was like, I might not want that someday.
You know, you were talking about the music story, and I do have a couple of guitars lying around the house, and I want to buy a drum set, and I have tattooed it on my arms.
Whoa! See, that's a commitment. That's cool.
But I haven't touched the guitar in a year. Oh. So.
Yeah, I often come back to this place of it's better to get rid of something, and if you miss it, get it back. You know what I mean? Like it's better to err on the side of no. And then if you do miss something, then you get it back. I was thinking about it, like 20 years ago, I was in a relationship where we were just like, where it was like, should we break up or should we not? And it's like, we were kind of like, I don't know. We said, well, how about this? Let's just break up. And then if we miss each other, we'll get back together. It's like when in doubt, err on the side of no. And so, yeah, we did break up. And after like 2 months, we're just like, okay, I hate being broken up. We were talking on the phone every other day. She kept coming over. We're just like, what are we doing? We're obviously like glued to each other. It felt better instead of saying like staying together because we're together. It's like, well, yeah, when in doubt, go back to nothing and see how much you miss it.
Yeah, and it really tests your kind of choice-making ability, because then it reinforces that it is a choice to do something, and you're not just doing it out of habit or by default, or, you know, because that can really breed resentment.
Yeah, well put. I like that.
So how do you approach making commitments if you do? And do you have a different kind of procedure for making commitments? Because obviously some commitments are easier to break than others. For example, the commitment to having a child is a much more long-term thing. But what about other
kinds of... Maybe it's not. Maybe he's got someone in the wings.
Maybe there's another family who's looking to adopt a kid just like this.
They were looking for a kid just like him, you know? Here you go. I don't need him. I mean, I'm sure I'll be okay without... No. Yeah, I just try to not make commitments whenever possible. Because I always feel like I'm going to let people down because I know my tendency to have no loyalty to things. I have no problem changing my mind and saying no to something I previously said yes to. I'm totally okay with that. Do I have a process for making commitments? No, I just really avoid it. I think there were times like 2 years ago, I lost 40 pounds because I had been saying I wanted to for years. And then it just became my top priority. I was just like, you know what? This is now my top priority. And as soon as I made it my top priority, all my actions fell in line with that. I completely cut out all sugar, wheat, dairy, even caffeine, just for the hell of it. I started eating like almost nothing. I waited till I was really, really hungry. If my tummy was actually grumbling, then I'd have a bowl of vegetables, otherwise nothing. And I lost 40 pounds in just like a few months. And when friends said like, whoa, how'd you do it? I was just like, it became a priority. Like then, I mean, you could say that was kind of a commitment, because then it was just like, yeah, of course this isn't fun, but it's like, this is now a commitment. It won't be a forever commitment. It was a few months. It could have gone on longer, but after a few months, I felt, okay, that's good enough. I'm happy now. And then something else became a higher priority than that. So does that help?
Yeah. Were you able to maintain that weight after you lost it?
Yeah.
How?
I don't know. Sorry, you're asking the wrong guy. I'm not a micromanager about that kind of stuff.
So it's like, yeah, you make commitments when the time feels right for you, and it's not a forever commitment. Do you communicate that to other people? Because sometimes the expectations that people have around these things are different.
I avoid public announcement. See, that's that whole accountability thing. Some people really get off on that, like, I'm going to publicly declare something and then I'm going to feel guilty and I'm going to hold myself to it because of social guilt, but that just doesn't work on me. Like, I have no problem bringing it. So it's a kind of a, there was a thing on my blog that a month and 2 days ago, I said, I'm going to start publishing something on my blog every single day. I'm not going to announce it. I'm just going to start doing it. So I started doing it. And after like 3.5 weeks, I thought, okay, some people are asking me like, what the hell's going on? Because I used to just post something on my blog every few months and I would email out every time I did. And suddenly I was posting every single day without emailing people. So some people were starting to ask like, did you kick me off the email list? What's going on? So I sent out something to my list saying, I'm doing this experiment where I'm posting something on my blog every single day. And if this continues, I might start a list about it. And then sure enough, just, you know, a few days after announcing that, I kind of went off to Paris with my kid for a few days and just decided not to bring my phone or computer and just like went with no tech. So it's like, I was offline for a few days. So it's like, well, there were no posts for a few days. And so it's like, no, there was no, I shouldn't have publicly said anything, but the fact that I did didn't suddenly make me feel that I had a boss or an obligation. I just felt like, I think I just, maybe feeling free is really important to me. I think I tend to have this rebellion even against myself. I always slept on like this side of the bed. And then I just caught myself, I was like, why do I always sleep on this side of the bed? It's like, let's switch. I'm going to take the other side for, and it's just like, I just constantly catch myself. If something starts to feel too much like a habit or addiction or some kind of rut, I'll just intentionally change it up just because.
All right, that was part one of our interview with Derek Sivers. You can find all the links and show notes at futurethinkers.org/116, and stay tuned for part two that goes out next week.
The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses, get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members. To stay up to date with new episodes, subscribe to Future Thinkers on your favorite platform. And leave us a review or a like. It really helps out the show. And don't forget to share this episode on social media. Enter the Future Thinkers giveaway and win our brand new community membership, including in-depth courses, private calls, and more, as well as a supply of Qualia, a complete cognitive upgrade for your brain. To enter the contest, simply go to futurethinkers.org/giveaway and sign up for our mailing list to instantly get our 50-page guide on how to adapt to the future. There are many ways to increase your chances of winning. Enter the competition today.
This episode is brought to you by Qualia, a nootropic supplement that helps support mental performance and mood. To get 10% off, use the code FUTURE at checkout. And to learn more about neurohacking, visit futurethinkers.org/neuro.